Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I'm your spotter, Justin Coletti. Tonight on the Conventional Sniper Podcast, we have special guest Anthony Sandoval. Welcome. Pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Justin. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, we've got kind of a little bit of history. We've been kind of known each other as friends since 2015. We've been stationed together for a little bit. Just so everyone's aware, this is the Sniper Podcast, and you are not a sniper, correct?
That is correct. I am not a sniper.
And what are you?
I retired out of the Army as a Sergeant First Class as a 19 Delta Cavalry Scout. Yes, I know. Trust me, I love my infantry brethren. But I bring to the table a reconnaissance background, something I think scout snipers or any scout section that employs snipers in a certain area would kind of get a similar understanding of what types of reconnaissance we do and why we do it.
We as in the cavalry scout or just the reconnaissance background in general?
Just, I would say anything in reconnaissance in general. We follow a similar guidelines, a little bit different mission sets as far as the whole scale picture goes. But we do work together to accomplish that mission and to develop that the battlefield and give that information to the battlefield commander as quickly and fast as possible.
All right. So kind of to back up real fast before we go any farther, I just want to kind of capitalize on some of the stuff from the first two podcasts we did. I have to apologize to everyone. On the first podcast, I did not realize how sensitive the microphones were. And I was clicking a pen in the background and I was like super nervous, you know. Everyone thinks, you know, only nerds do podcasts, so I kind of had that mindset going to the first one. So I apologize for all those that gave feedback and said, hey, dude, I can hear the pen in the background, and it's going to drive me nuts, and if you don't knock it off, I'm going to spam block your podcast. So I apologize for that. Second off, I want to basically give a shout-out to OSOK Apparel, O-S-O-K Apparel. I've reached out to them in transparency. I want to be transparent. I reached out to them. They're a sniper-based veteran apparel company. They do stuff specifically for snipers. I own their hats and their shirts. And this is long before I did the podcast. So I reached out to them and said, hey, here's the podcast. We'd like to have you guys kind of on and be part of our community and the podcast. And so they were kind enough to give us a discount code. So if you want to head over to their website, it's osok-apparel, osok-apparel.com. You can use the discount code SNIPERPODCAST, all lowercase, one word. Again, that's Sniper Podcast, and you could get 10% off store wide. So if you're looking for some sweet swag to let everyone know else that you're a badass and they're not, and you're not the common soldier, then go ahead and head over to their store and check some stuff out. I do love their hats. I will admit, like I wear, it's around here somewhere. I just had it on my head and I put it down, but their hats are nice. Like the sweet ball cap type hat. They also have the flat bill hats, but I have a really small, awkward head. So I really, really have a good niche for nice hats, but they've got a good hat. One thing that they do have is they do have like the longer shirts that kind of cut off mid forearm. I do wear their shirts a lot at the range when I'm shooting because it also helps keep the bugs away, and it is a thinner shirt, so I can stay cool in the hotter months and as well as keep the bugs away. So kind of moving on with that, I want to kind of give a back brief to my buddy Jedediah Robbins. I mentioned him in the first podcast again. He is my old sniper section sergeant. He's going to be at the Gathering, which is a reminder, it's next weekend. The second, third, and fourth is the Sniper, U.S. Army Sniper Association and the Marine Corps Scout Sniper Association, first ever Gathering. It's where both organizations are coming together. It's in Colorado, Denver specifically. So Rob will be on the podcast, and he's going to kind of cover with me selection, you know, what sniper sections are looking for or should be looking for, what he did to select the section, specifically because I was one of the guys that he selected. So that's kind of a good insight for that. And he's going to kind of go over all of that. I mentioned a little bit in the podcast before the first one, like I said, that I would discuss how to get into a section, and I didn't really cover it very well. I kind of just gave you just the tip, and Rob's going to go more in depth with it. So I figured it'd only be fitting that he discuss it because he's done most of the selecting. I have done selecting for sections, but it wasn't as intensive as what he did for selection. So he'll go over that sort of stuff. So anyway, back to the podcast. So one thing about sniping is you have to understand that there's a history associated with it. And everything in any military starts somewhere. And one thing that is important is you have to understand that hunting is usually looked back upon as the beginning of marksmanship, the beginning of sniping. But additionally, that comes with the territory of technology. So I understand that the formal sniper was established by the British Army in the early 1900s with the Lovat Scouts. They were, to my knowledge, the first ever unit to have ghillie suits, and they were specific and trained towards marksmanship. But after talking to Anthony, he's kind of given me a little bit more of a background as to the term marksman and where it really picked up on the conventional side. And it's kind of important to understand this history. So, hey, Sandy, welcome again to the podcast. Let's go ahead and jump into this a little bit. So if you don't mind, just tell me a little bit about your Army background. I know you said you were 19 Delta, but if you could be a little bit more specific and kind of give the listeners a 411, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I joined the Army in July of 2008. My first duty assignment after I passed it, initially OSUT and then Airborne School, was the 82nd Airborne Division. I jumped in right into my first deployment into Iraq. First part was in Baghdad, and our later part of our deployment was in the Dial River Valley. The and kind of jumping into that as a young individual and early was, you know, it was very important to understand, you know, everything. I didn't get the training like most dudes got. I learned it firsthand and live. And for me, I felt like that really set the tone in my Army career, because I understood the reasons why we were doing training and what it was about and the importance of the understanding the what and the why we do it, but not also to focus on specific, not only just outcomes, but the performance measures of, hey, this is, you know, our procedures, this is our troop leading procedures, this is how we employ weapons, this is how we, you know, X, Y, Z, and I try to pass that knowledge along to many amount of soldiers that I had. I have experience in both light scout configurations as well as mechanized. I spent a couple of years in Fort Carson, Colorado with the 4th Infantry Division. Got my hand on some tankety-tank Bradleys. It's a completely different style of reconnaissance than what I was ever used to. And I'm really glad I got that background. Just for a larger understanding of, you know, the different concepts of how we employ our weapons of warfare. And like I said, the reconnaissance background, yes, it's all based around the same stuff, but how we did it and how we employed these tools to our advantage was a lot different than being the guy on the ground.
I mean, you kind of were the guy on the ground. You're still a cavalryman moving about the battle space. You're not an aircraft. You're still a guy on the ground.
And I would say it's the reason why I say it's a little bit different is because we're trying to maneuver large machinery that's loud. You know, most of the time in reconnaissance elements, we move at night. Well, we're driving this humongous tank-like Bradley that's loud, it clunks, it can only fit in certain areas. And part of our job doing reconnaissance is not only are we trying to develop the enemy composition, where they're at and where they're moving, but we're reporting many more other things, the type of terrain, how you're navigating through the terrain, can you navigate through the terrain, overall painting that picture to the battlefield commander saying, hey, you got over to your west, you can't maneuver over here. It's too thick, either forest or it's high canyon walls, high elevation terrain, Humvees, rocks and stuff. You're going to start blowing tires. And so you're trying to paint this picture. You're trying to develop these routes, not only for the guys that are going to be coming up behind us, but as well as kind of developing a picture like, okay, if this is what the terrain is like as we're going through it, it's probably pretty similar as the enemy's coming through. And we start to develop these natural pathways saying, hey, this is more than likely this is where they're going to come from. But as far as being on the ground and being using the old leather personnel carriers, it's a little bit different element.
By leather personnel carriers, you mean boots?
Yes.
Boots. Okay, sorry.
Yes, boots. Now, you're moving around on foot.
Leather personnel carriers. I have heard this term a few times, and I have joked about it, but now that I'm out of the Army, and I, you know, we joke about leather personnel carriers, I'm like, yeah, I got some leather personnel carriers, and they're jacked up, because they're the same Army boots I still have. Like, I still have the original first ever combat pair I had in Afghanistan. And those things are like the heels have like a 45 degree angle in them for me to roll my ankle all the time. And the boots, like the eyelets or whatever, those are completely torn out. Like my toes are basically sticking out of them. I wore those boots for a straight year and I refused to change boots. I was like, if I change boots, it's going to get me killed. So I refuse to change boots. But you know, those are the best leather personnel carriers I've ever had.
That's funny you say that, because I have the old Panama soles sitting in my garage still. And from that
But the Panama soles are like a really thin desert boot, right?
It really is. It is a really thin desert boot. I have the same heels worn at a 45. I like the lighter step for me, being able to move at night. Like I said, in some unknown areas, I like to be able to kind of feel what was below my feet at the expense of the cushion on my knees. So, but like...
You don't need knees. You got two of them.
Yeah, I got two of them, right?
That's what they make prosthetics for nowadays.
Like I said, it just kind of, it changed, it definitely changed like the element and kind of the size of reconnaissance picture that we were doing at the time. I've seen mechanized is a very, very large scale. You're looking at a much bigger picture as opposed to being the guy on the ground where you're still doing some of the same things, still reporting terrain, avenues of approach, routes, but it's in a much smaller sector.
So what's your impressions of Sniper as it pertains to light versus in, well, let's just ask this. Let's go back. What is your impression of infantry snipers?
So infantry snipers, you know, we've used them quite a bit, especially when I was in the 82nd. Our sniper assets and the way we were designed was an Arista squadron. So in full spectrum of warfare, we would actually break apart the squadron and be a asset to a battalion, usually about a troop, which is similar to an infantry company. Mm-hmm. A little bit smaller in size, but we would be that asset. Now, we know within our infantry battalions that they have the scouts, and then they also have the sniper teams.
There's a distinction between cavalry scouts and infantry scouts. And I know some cavalry scout is going to roll in his grave right now. And I know some infantry guy is going to beat his chest and stand up tall, which, hey, good for you, brother, but... The cavalry scout doesn't go through a selection process. They go through their infantry, or not their infantry, but they go through their basic training. They go through their MOS qualification, their military occupational specialty, their job training. Correct. And then they're sent forward to a unit. So they're not actually, like, there's no selection process to be a higher mechanized or light infantry cavalry scout, correct?
That is correct.
So we'll get kind of back to that later, because I have some questions about that as it pertains to the cavalry back in the history, but... Continue with the sniper stuff. I just want to set that apart so people understand that to be a sniper, you still have to go through a selection process.
Absolutely. So the difference is our mission picture. For me, as a cavalryman attached to an infantry battalion working with infantry scouts that have been through a selection process and as well as a sniper team, our mission sets were different, but they always were within unison of each other. Us being the traditional cavalryman, we were stuck with the larger picture of conducting movement, finding the routes, pinning the terrain, and also gaining enemy composition. Our infantry scout brethren, for lack of better terms, was more focused on what we would call an area reconnaissance. So
like bigger picture. Like a probe, right?
Kind of like a probe, yes. So the bigger picture would be a zone. So we're assigning a zone. It could be, you know, a few kilometers wide. It could be smaller than that. It could be larger than that. And an area is more specific, like this village. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now... They would work around the outside of the village, probing it, kind of cloverleaf style, gathering what's going in and out. And then your infantry or your sniper teams, they were the guys that focused on the known areas of interest. So they would be the ones that would go in and deploy. They would, you know, do their they'd set in their OP, whatever it is.
Like a final firing position.
Yep, little
their
fire,
hide site,
you know,
surf site.
Yeah, hide site, surf site, whatever they're trying
serve,
to use.
Serve meaning surveillance.
Surveillance, yes, correct. Or, you know, it also use the field craft to, you know, camouflage themselves, and they would be there for a good amount of time. And their objective, majority of the time, was to find the key player. And a lot of that is watching body language, where, as opposed to me being the cavalryman, that would take a lot of resources for us to focus on one specific component of a reconnaissance asset when I have the other role of what's everything else moving in and around that place. So my focus is more large scale.
So what you do is you help narrow down where the sniper can focus his efforts on. Like, hey, we have this village. Its enemy composition is X. Let's say it's a battalion size. Well, a company commander can dispatch the snipers and be like, hey, this battalion, I need you to take out as many officers as you can in this area. I need you to take out as many machine gun nests or as radio men. I need you to do all this sort of stuff. So you help narrow down, basically, from what I'm gathering,
yes,
where the sniper can focus his efforts on instead of just tossing a dart at the wall.
That is correct. So that would actually be, I would say, a very, very accurate term. We basically give the senses of, hey, this area over here within this zone is something we need to focus on. There's a lot of activity over here. This is what we're seeing. And like I said, I'm not focused too much on the smaller picture, but more of the large scale.
So I know at the battalion level, most information from you guys comes up to S2, which is the intelligence gathering shop, so correct, to speak, right? So do you think it'd be better for the snipers to integrate directly with you guys, set up that relationship with the scouts, the 19 Deltas, have that connection if there is a 19 Delta section? Because I know, like when I was in 10th Mountain, there was no 19 Deltas. That was a cavalry scout unit at battalion level, and they had their own thing. But when the infantry unit that I was in, there was no 19 Deltas. So they had the relationship with their regular scouts, who kind of did the same thing, but light infantry, you can't really move around as much. Or I shouldn't say as much, but as fast than mechanized. So do you think it's pertinent for that sniper to develop a relationship, that network, that tact with the mechanized scout platoon? Because I would think at it from my perspective that it's much faster to get the information direct than having it go up to the C2 element or the S2 element. And I know the S2 element's job is to decipher that information, but the scouts and the snipers, I would think that would work hand in hand, would understand that platoon sergeant would understand, at least at the scouts, like, hey, this is definitely an area the snipers need to be in. I don't need to coordinate this to S2. It needs to go to snipers. Then I'll coordinate to S2, because I know the battalion commander's looking at his overall picture. But if that scout understands the battalion commander and the sniper role, he should be able to be like, hey, this is where you're going to go. Here's what I'm seeing. You need to go here. Begin your movement.
I would definitely say that is that'd be a wonderful way to employ, and I'm going to tell you that, yes, we have done that before. We have had sniper teams directly assigned to support our larger scale reconnaissance movements specifically for that purpose. And it depends on, I would say, the difference between, movement and mechanized versus the light scout platform is kind of the concept of how we're designed. As far as firepower goes. So the overall concept is, we say alone and unafraid, which means you got a squad-sized platoon for infantry squad's equivalent.
Yeah, is about so like nine dudes.
Yeah, nine to 13 dudes maybe. And we're moving through. We have five gun trucks, if we're lucky, with a lot of firepower and being able to be out there and self-sustainable. Now, when it comes to moving vehicles and being in small numbers, where do your dismounts come from? Well, now you have a driver and a gunner sitting back in that vehicle by themselves, basically sitting on what we call a screen line, which is basically a hide sight for a vehicle, watching anything that's coming in and out. Our dismounts are the ones that are probing forward and kind of setting up those LPOPs in specific
LPs, meaning listening posts, observation posts. So you're just a forward sensor is essentially what you're doing.
Essentially,
and you're just relaying that information back. And for you guys, the screen line is, from what I understand, is twofold. It gives the enemy the perception that there's a massive element there by the amount of firepower you have if you have to engage.
Correct.
If not, then you're a listening post and observation post, which you're just observing what's in front of you with the ability to maintain mobility as well as being static when necessary.
Absolutely. And so, I'm going to say there's a lot of times where I've seen screen lines also become what's called area security. So we're sitting on a screen line. Yes, we're watching anything coming in and out, depending on the makeup of the brigade, whether it's airborne, whether it's mechanized. Usually developing while you're going into a new area is the massing of troops. We're building our log packs, our establishment, basically the... for a drop zone, for example, for airborne troops. First thing comes in, combat troops hit the ground, scouts hit the ground. We push out, we set up a screen line. We're trying to observe anything that's going around the area and safeguard the landing zone, which has now become the main center hub for
resupply.
As they build combat power. Once combat power is built, we'll start moving forward. So the screen line is kind of...
You're just a heavy-hitting... A heavy-hitting reconnaissance element.
Basically.
Where versus a sniper is that the sniper is the brigade or the battalion's scalpel, essentially, right?
Essentially.
So you guys are the mobile, I would say, ball-peen hammer. right? The ball peen hammer is only necessary when jobs need to be done. If not, it's still there. It's still doing its thing, right? And not a sledgehammer, because you guys don't have the operational forces to kick in doors, clear things, fight a large element. You can take another scout elements, but even then you're playing with danger a little bit because you're technically, in the real world of mechanized, you're matching with firepower, and that's something you technically don't really want to get involved with. But you're not the scalpel like the sniper is.
Absolutely correct? Not. And I would say for any element that's scout, sniper, infantry sniper, scout
platoon. No, you're correct in that because 19 Deltas can go to sniper school. They are awarded correct. The additional skill identifier.
It is.
They do get the certificate for passing. And I do know there is, in fact, I would say a quarter of my class was 19 Deltas when I went through in 2014.
When I was going through ALC, I know that was part of the Chief Armor's vision was to actually have these hard-slotted positions within a scout platoon, even scout troops or scout squadrons, to have these specialized slots available for guys that have these special training, Pathfinder school, sniper schools, ranger school.
So they're adding combat enablers to the reconnaissance.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, you're trying to, you know, enable your team as best as possible. You have a guy that's strong in a skill asset. His job is to teach everyone else that skill. Not necessarily saying you can just take a guy that graduated sniper school and make every one of your platoon snipers, but he has some knowledge he can pass on, and that's the advantage of it. But we're getting
bring everyone up instead of just hold on the info.
Teach them teach them different types of techniques, or make the not this is what I'm doing, but this is why I'm doing it more relevant.
Makes sense, yeah.
And kind of get the aha moment clicking in some guys. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe sometimes that's all they need. But going back to the element of what I'm out there on the screen line, yeah, once combat power is established, we're moving forward. But like I said, my picture's on a larger scale. So we've used sniper teams assigned to us specifically for what we developed as known areas of interest where we suspect a lot of heavy-hitting movement, whether it be officers, whether it be high-value targets.
Or targets of opportunity in general,
yeah. Right? And we have a saying, a seen scout's a dead scout. And I'm sure anybody that serves in a reconnaissance element knows you're best off not being seen.
Mm-hmm.
If you can see the enemy,
it's the same thing with snipers. Like, you should always assume that you're being watched. If you can see the enemy can see you. And so you have to be very, very precautious in your movements.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's no different with the 19 Delta series or the cavalrymen, which, you know, going back in history, you've got the term infant. And this is, you explained it to me earlier, yes. This is like a couple weeks ago, and I kind of chuckled because where I work now, like, I'm a GS civilian, I work for a recruiting battalion in New England. So if you're in New England and you want to join the infantry, come talk to me. I'm at the battalion and we'll have a chit chat. Anyway, so I understand, like, we have a dictionary at the battalion. And the only thing that was ever highlighted in the dictionary was the word infantry. And I was like, I'm going to read it one day, because I literally sit next to the dictionary at my desk, and I saw the term infant. And I was like, is this literally saying like a child, like an infant? And I just happened to bring it up to you in conversation one day, and you're like, oh yeah, like it is an infant. But I didn't know the rest of the story.
So going back to, yes, when being part of the cavalry, this is long before tanks and everything special that changed to what it is today. To be the most elite soldier on the battlefield was to be a cavalryman. Now, the word term infantry or foot soldier comes from the term infant, which means the individual was too young to join the cavalry or dragoons, depending on country element during the time.
And what we're talking about early times is like 1600s, 1700s.
1600s, horsemanship
before World War I.
Yeah, definitely go before that. So when cavalries were used back in the Roman times. But we're going to talk about more modern-type technology when there's firearms involved. Let's go back. I would say
the dragoon wasn't a thing back in Roman times.
It wasn't. So that's where I'm kind of... 18th century.
Yeah.
Okay, so 18th century, which leads us to another, you know, really good point on, you know, our early terms of marksmen. When you go back to what you... talking about the advancement of warfare of the British snipers in the 1900s developing ghillie suits. Let's go back to a specific time frame in our nation's history in the American Revolution of the Saratoga campaign. Right, you have the British general, General Burgoyne, trying to attack, moving in from Canada down south along the Hudson Bay River. Right, so what the way he was doing this was he was building a road. Along the way, he had a...
By road, you mean really just like a pathway, because they don't have like concrete back then, obviously.
So, us being who we are, I mean, we're a ragtag bunch of rebels that are banded together and fighting the most powerful army or empire in the world at the time. Use more guerrilla type tactics. So we started chopping down trees, just making a ton of obstacles, which is also another employment of what scouts would do. If we were trying to set up
terrain denial, basically.
Terrain denial, yes, to set up a certain kill zone, right?
Right.
This is more on the mechanized side where we use hunter killer teams with Bradleys and Abrams tanks.
You see that in aircraft too. That's kind of getting off topic. We'll come back to the aircraft stuff. But
we're going back, so there's a specific individual, Daniel Morgan, General Daniel Morgan. He wasn't a general at the time, but he had a provisional rifle corps. And the advancement in warfare at the time for these guys were the American long rifle. It was the early example of a firearm with rifling. It was about 7.5 pounds, typically about a .48 caliber, that advanced marksmen were able to shoot anywhere from 100 to 200 yards. Now, that may not be like much for anybody, but we're
I don't know. I've seen some non-infantry types have a problem shooting targets 200 yards, so maybe they should pick up some muskets and might do a little bit better.
Well, we're going to go through the, it's the round lead marble. And we're going to compare it against the British's Brown Best rifles, which is about 10 pounds, shot a 75 caliber, and can shoot 100 yards with their best marksman. So 100% advantage. And what these specific marksmen did in this provisional rifle corps was they targeted Burgoyne's Indian scouts that were leading him along the way. They targeted him so much to a point that the scouts decided to stop siding with Burgoyne and be a neutral party. Now, our disruptment during this time, or this terrain denial of chopping down trees, shooting their scouts, basically slowed him down so much that he was only able to advance a mile a day. Now, when it came time to go into the first major battle of the Saratoga campaign, he was so exhausted at the point that these American marksmen had completely not only dislodged his scouts, his element that he had that was navigating him through the Hudson Bay River area, but then they started targeting British officers. Which, if anybody's ever done anything with the British, they don't do anything without the command of an officer.
Yeah, once you smack an officer in the face, you know that whole element's gone. And you know, surprisingly, that's from what I understand from history, that's a lot of modern day armies still. They rely on that officer to kind of lead the way and show the officer is supposed to have that level of education. Versus the American army nowadays, it's not the officer is only there to, I don't want to say this, contain and not allow the NCO leadership to get out of control. That's that. Otherwise, the NCOs lead the fight. Like, there's an old saying that generals plan wars, sergeants lead wars, and privates win wars. And it's the same thing. Like, the modern-day officer, no matter what education level you come from, whether you went to West Point or you went to New Hampshire Technical Community College, if you went through ROTC versus that West Point graduate, your job is still... is still to contain the infantry, the NCOs, and the junior leadership. And I say junior leadership as in the E1 to E4, because we know that every infantry soldier is supposed to know his job plus two ranks above him. And if everyone else gets killed, and there's plenty of examples throughout history where that private E1 is like, hey, dude, my entire battalion's gone, and I'm just here to kick ass because I have nothing else to do, so I'm going to slaughter everyone I can. And they win the day, and they hold an entire sector by themselves. It's like Joe Bazelone. Joe Bazelone is a Medal of Honor recipient. Excuse me, John, sorry. And he's there with a machine gun, and he literally annihilated an entire Japanese regiment. Annihilated them with one machine gun. So to say that the American Army has it set down and correct, and even the Marine Corps, sorry to leave you guys out, like NCO leadership is the way to lead the Army. Or the force, the officers there is only to restrain the NCOs from getting out of control, to direct them to focus their power and their influence and their motivation and their leadership so that the goal can be accomplished. Versus the British are like, hey, I'm an officer, I contain everything. So when you have an early marksman who has a rifle that can reach up to 200, 100% advantage over the regular British infantryman who's standing in the line, which is where the term the line comes from in the infantry, is literally when you stood in a line toe-to-toe-to-toe with everyone, you got within 100 yards of each other, and you smacked each other in the face with a bunch of lead balls. So at that point, like you're saying, the Americans have the advantage.
Yes, that is correct. And it proved, obviously, very fruitful for the Americans, and a major standpoint to actually go out to Benedict Arnold, which we all know as the infamous traitor later on in history. Well, not later on in those years, but early in our history. But actually, I'm going to tell you about something else that I found that was during that time frame, and I'm a huge Revolutionary War buff.
Dude, I know. We live in New England. You and I have sat in the exact same halls as George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Paul Revere. We have drank in the same places as our founding fathers. It's pretty legit to think that we can go to the same places where they drank. And additionally, we've also been to the same spot where there are still British dead, British, soldiers killed in action, and we can literally hover over their graves on American soil. So I understand you're a historical buff, so to speak. So continue.
Well, anyways, so finding this information, so I was trying to get, a little more detailed information about the American long rifle. And I found actually the most advanced rifle of the era during the revolutionary time frame was the Ferguson rifle. And it was developed by a major, and the capability was 3 times the amount of what the Brown Best could produce.
The Brown Best being a smoothbore musket.
Smoothbore musket. So you're basically just closing your eyes and hoping for the best. 100 yards, dude, if you're the very best marksman out there,
Dude, I have to be honest. I got to give some credit to some Revolutionary War vets. And if you are, make sure you hashtag us on Instagram. But I could not stand knowing combat has, how has it evolved over years. There's no way that you would ever catch me standing in a line toe-to-toe with a bunch of British with a smoothbore rifle thinking that I could somehow survive the day and achieve victory. You got to have some straight balls of steel to do that, knowing that, I'm sure you've seen The Patriot in the beginning series where dude's just getting cut in half by stuff. And even then, medicine back in the day, dude, if you got hit with a lead ball and it was in your extremity, your arm or your leg, you lost that entire leg. There was no, let's remove the ball, let's contain the wound and make sure he doesn't get gangrene. Dude, you had lead poisoning. That was it. You're dead. So the only way to make sure you didn't die is to cut off your entire limb. So if you got one in the gut, dude, you're set aside to die. That's it. So if you imagine now you've got this marksman who has a rifle that can reach out and really do some damage to the officers, even if he doesn't score a critical hit, let's say he gets him on a limb, gets that guy in the foot while he's on a horse. Because as I know, no British officer is going to be standing on the ground. He's going to be on a horse. If he's any sort of command authority, he's going to be either next to the colors or he's going to be on a horse.
The prize target.
Yep.
So going back to the Ferguson rifle, so 7.5 pounds, 200 to 300 yards with advanced marksman. Now, the problem with this rifle was there's only 4 gunsmiths in the nation that could produce this rifle, and they couldn't produce 100 rifles within a 6-month time period, and it was 4 times the cost. So it was kind of a lost, kind of got lost towards the late 1778 to the early 1780 time frame, which, that leads us into, obviously, we're going back to the 1900s here with probably, I would argue, one of the most advancements in warfare going into World War One. We still use machine guns and sidearms from that era with little to no changes.
Besides smokeless powder and that sort of thing. The French invented smokeless powder.
They did.
And that's what really kind of established the true modern day snipers, when you now can hide because you have that smokeless powder. Versus back in the day, everyone's got a bunch of smoke flying around, just the one big signal fire in the middle of an open field. Hey, we're killing everyone right here. Everyone, this smoke, that's where everyone dies. Let's just go fight it out. It's cool. We'll stand 100 yards from each other, real men, and do it out. Today, no, man.
Real man. I think that was the gentleman way to fight. For me,
you gentlemen, during that time, gentleman, right? Okay.
Gentleman way to fight it. If it was me during that time frame, and I would say, we're going to say, if I was there, this is what I would do. I would fight the same way we did, guerrilla style. Why stand toe-to-toe with these dudes? They got the bigger cannons, and there's a lot more of them shooting these smoothbore shotgun spread at me. I'm not standing toe-to-toe to those guys. I'm going to shoot them from the woodline.
So with all this, like, all this advancement in technology, was there any translation into the hunter? Or is this the modern rifle? I shouldn't say the modern rifle, but with that rifle having this, the rifling in it, was that specifically just for the military, or is there a demand in the hunting side too?
So it's kind of got lost doing a little bit of research on it. It was the American long rifle was first designed like early in the 1700s, and I think its primary use was for hunting. And obviously, it led into further development into the Kentucky rifle, very well known hunting rifle of Daniel Boone and
David Crockett.
Yeah, there we go, Davy Crockett.
I saw that. Like, hey, dude, I need some help here.
The Kentucky long rifle, and also the Pennsylvania long rifle.
So that being said, like, you understand the history of marksmanship. So how did you get involved in marksmanship? Because in a scout section, it's not so necessarily harped on, like, you need to be a straight shot. It's more harped on, you need to understand your reconnaissance aspect. You need to understand how to communicate.
I would say, yeah, I definitely agree with that. The scout side is more focused on, hey, primary weapons, obviously, the radio.
Is your radio.
Artillery, CAS assets, and then crew serve weapons and tow missiles, and if we can't kill them then, we got to fight out with rifles. Well, we're already dead anyway, so.
So how did you get started, like, in real marksmanship?
So how I got started in real marksmanship is I grew up hunting with my dad, and I'm going to tell you the grumpy individual, I would say, gave me a very rudimentary base fundamentals of marksmanship. It was more like, hold your breath, shoot this thing. If you don't hit it, I'm going to slap you upside the head kind of deal. And a lot of that
was... So wait, your dad would hit you upside the head if you missed?
Not really. I just felt like I would disappoint him if I did miss, so I actually never really did.
Metaphorically got smacked upside the head.
Yeah, so metaphorically, sure. I definitely agree with that.
Your dad was a metaphorical sniper. That's what happened, is your dad understood how to smack that ass from a distance.
I would say we also were the masters of the good old term Kentucky windage, because there was definitely no dials on any of the scopes that I had.
Was it the old duplex reticles where it's just a solid crosshair all the way across?
Yep, solid duplex, $20 from freaking Walmart, homemade scope mount on a 30-30 was the first rifle I ever hunted with.
Oh, man.
770 yards, first mule deer, shot him in the neck.
With a 30-30?
With a 30-30.
Dude, there are guys right now that can't even hit a target at 700 yards with a 308. And
I was 12 years old.
You hit a mule deer at 12 years old with a lever action 30-30.
And the first thing I ever hunted was javelina, and I actually shot that thing in the neck too, but I was 20 yards from it. It was more of a kind of that oh shit moment, for lack of a better term.
Dude, I have to admit, when I went out to Arizona, for the listeners, I was sponsored by a company called Polycase Ammunition, and they've now turned into Interceptor Ammunition. So Paul Lemke, if you're listening to this podcast, you owe me a phone call. Anyway, I digress. So when I went out there, and we went out there with a buddy of mine who was in my old unit, his name is Joseph D'Ambrosia, and he's the marketing director of Rochester Precision Optics. And Rochester Precision Optics makes all the electrical optics, for the most part, for SIG. So when SIG comes to the drawing board and they said, hey, we want to create this optic, they go to RPO, or Rochester Precision Optics. So he's the marketing director for them. And he was a good old infantry guy. He wanted to be a sniper through and through. He's got more pictures with the French snipers when we were in Afghanistan than I know any dude ever in my life. However, he was like my very first ever team leader. Him and this guy named Matt Gallagher. And those dudes would destroy me every second of the day. If I mistied my shoes by like an inch, he would annihilate me. But anyway, so when we went out there, you were explaining to me, like, I came in your dad's garage or whatever, and I was like, oh, what's this super crazy animal up on the wall? And you guys were like, that's a javelina. And I, like, instantly thought about the nightmares that I was going to have looking at this animal in the garage. And you're looking at me like, yeah, yeah, I know. But, dude, seriously, I thought I was going to have nightmares over this pig that's on the wall. It's legitimately a pig, right? That's what it is?
Yeah, it's basically a pig from hell. It's got very covered and bristled type, almost like a hedgehog kind of deal going on. Just rough, I don't even want to call it fur because it's like bristles. Crazy looking tusks, and it's actually not a very big animal, but man, they smell terrible. And your fascination with them was actually it's pretty comical because my dad's always telling me, like, hey, when's he coming out to come have Lena hunt? You know, we got to put in by February. And I'm like, all right, yeah, we'll figure it out. And I'm thinking to myself, like, man, I don't even want to be around those things again. It's because I'm scared of them, just because they smell so bad.
I want to shoot them because they look like the devil's guard dog. Like, I'm just like,
yeah, definitely.
Like, if that thing was to be in hell and it was to be like an animal, like man's best friend, the devil would have a javelina. And that, like, when I saw that thing in the garage, I was like, dude, I don't know what that is, but I need to carry a gun on me everywhere I go.
I think of it more of like, I'd say in the pig world, it's more of like the crazy looking chihuahua of pigs.
I wouldn't call that a chihuahua. I'd call that something that wants to literally eat my own bacon.
Well, I mean, versus,
pun intended, you know, there with the pigs.
Well, versus the wild, you know, the wild boar you'd see down south. Yeah, down Georgia south. Stuff,
like bedding. Yeah. Which, cool story, a little side story. So when I was at sniper school, and there's two main ranges that they have at sniper school. One is like the dedicated sniper range, and there's a bunch of Connexes and stuff like that on it. The other one is kind of like they share it with the mechanized side, like the scouts. They share it for gunnery. And on the other one, the dedicated sniper range, pigs, like wild boar, walk across that range all the time. So once you've done your record fire one, or I think in the new manual it's called G1, like your graded exercise one, your first qualification, which you do with the M110 SAS, which is just it's SAS stands for a semi-automatic sniper rifle. It's made by Nines Armament. I talked about it in the third podcast. An AR-10. Yeah, fancy AR-10. But they've got a bunch of boars that generally walk across the range. And our sniper's instructor's like, look, if you understand target detection, hey, guns free, dude. Like, you've already qualified. You're qualified. You're basically already there. Everything else is a cumulative from here. It's not a go, no go. And which record fired one is a go, no go. Either you pass it or you don't. And if you don't, you have one other chance to pass it. And if you don't pass it, you and your spotter go home. Like, there's no like, oh, this guy only got 5 shots out of 10 and this guy got, you know, this guy, you have to have a cumulative score of 70% between you and your spotter, you and your partner. And if you don't achieve that 70% overall and you have like, you know, 10 shots each, like, dude, you're going home. You and your buddy. So you could get teamed up with a dude from another unit. Like, say you come from Alaska and I come from Fort Benning and we end up at the same unit or in the same school as or in the same class as partners. And if we don't do that record fire one together, we both go home from separate units. So that's like one thing about sniper school that's pretty imperative that most people don't understand is that if you're not working well with your partner, as you would in a combat scenario or even in hunting, if you and your buddy are going out hunting, you know, say one of you's got tags and the other doesn't, one guy's acting as a spotter, another's the shooter, and you don't, you know, identify a target through your reconnaissance, like you're reconnaissing in a scenario. And that's why I brought you on, is because we can break down that reconnaissance portion in a little bit. But if you're not understanding the terrain, you're not understanding the aspect, and none of you take a shot or get to the point where you can identify a target, whether it be a human being, if a sniper, or if you're a hunter, or even if you're in the precision rifle thing, and there are matches out there that you'll just have a wood line and you have to scan the wood line for the target. Like the match you and I went to in Maryland, all the targets are set forth. We knew where all they were. You were helping me. That was your first match. You were helping me identify these targets and check my data as a normal spotter would, the experienced sniper. But, you know, if you don't identify that target, can't engage it. You can't shoot what you can't see. So just that whole aspect was super impressive to see the javelina and learning from you guys out there, and just everything was like super impressive to me. But kind of getting back to that, like, we're going to go back to the same question because we kind of got off track. So how did you get in precision rifle? We could go for hours for it like this, but how did you get a precision rifle?
Like I said, you know, being the scout thing, it was obviously part of my key element of it was being a master of the cruiserive weapons, which is not a very hard task for guys that are motivated and love shooting machine guns. But I grew up, like I said, my first real unit in my environment was deployed, so I became very, very proficient in close quarters combat out to mid range and kind of max, you know, using my personally assigned weapon to the best of my ability. And I really focused on that. And like I said, a lot of my early focus was on close quarter combat to maybe about mid-range. Excuse me. But then kind of, you know, when I met you and stuff, like, I just kind of came up here, and I wasn't really shooting on my own that whole lot. I was always shot expert and stuff every time I went out to qual, but, you know, that is pop-up targets. It is what it is. And my main focus was close quarters combat, and then you and I, we started getting involved in these competitions, these excellence
in competition. Yeah,
excellence in competition.
The EIC stuff.
The EIC stuff with the service rifle, and kind of mastering that rifle, and then, you know, just down to the base fundamentals of using iron sights. Like, hey, there's a lot more to just when you're trying to slice your front flight post into thirds versus dialing in wind on your rear sight aperture at 500 yards is quite a task. So it kind of opened up my eyes, like, hey, you know, I really enjoy this stuff. And I further went on, and I went with you, and we both got certified instructors for through the NRA for patrol rifle for law enforcement. And then I went on my own and did the master rifle instructor cert at 6-Hour Academy, which is more focused on, I wouldn't really say the shooting aspect. Yes, it was a tough shooting course, and there was a lot of very, I would say, special side guys involved in that class, and I kind of felt I was a little out of my element. But once we started getting shooting and stuff, I was confident, and honestly, I wasn't impressed with a lot of the competition that I saw there.
By competition, you mean just other candidates?
Other candidates.
When you were taking the master rifle course?
Yeah, when I was taking the master rifle course, you know, we had some Norwegian Special Forces guys, two guys out of the BOP from Brazil, and then three Australian counterterrorism unit guys in this course. So obviously, first meeting, they're all dressed out in their kit, and I'm just some dude.
You're just a conventional guy.
Conventional guy. Like, I'm not wearing a uniform. I'm just wearing some cargo pants and a polo, like, with my battle belt. Like, hey, let's get this thing going. And I kind of felt like, what am I doing here for a second? And then we started getting shooting and stuff. And I kind of felt like, you know, I was able to give these guys that have excelled themselves in a certain career aspect some tips. And, you know, they're helping me with certain things. And, you know, we kind of just flowed, you know, that level of information. Like, I'm going to help you. You're going to help me. We're going to critique each other, and we're going to also challenge each other. We got the same thing. I'm going to outshoot you this time. Like, okay, you know. And so once I got that portion down, I would definitely say that I kind of felt like I was stuck. And then you were really getting focused in. I knew you were a sniper in the background. Like I said, growing up hunting, like long bolt or long guns with bolt actions and scopes is something I've always kind of wanted to do. And so I went with you down to the precision rifle course down in Maryland, and I've never been to sniper school. So I'm learning this stuff kind of out of a handbook and kind of just by word of mouth from you. You're teaching me things, and I'm trying to apply the why to the what of being able to call wind, being able to understand the differences in ranges and degrees and temperature as far as what it does to you. Obviously, when you sight in a rifle at 100 degrees in the summertime versus shooting in the winter when it's 30 degrees out and you have sustained winds or vortex winds going on like we did down in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
What was the first shoot right out of the box, right?
That was like the most miserable shot I've ever taken. I'm in a bread truck. Literally, like if you were to go and pick up like a Wonder Bread delivery truck, I was in that truck prone, like 2 or 3 feet off the ground in the truck. I'm shooting through a window in a door, like an ambulance window door in the back, at a target at like 1,000 yards. And of course, there's no wind in the morning. And I'll admit, when I go to the precision rifle comps, I love to be the first guy to shoot because the wind is like, it doesn't exist. It's early in the morning. The temperature's calm. Mirage is either really good because the sun's coming up, or there's no mirage, but I can tell by the vegetation all the way out to distance what the wind's doing. So I could be like, all right, calm winds. I got a center hold, man. Like, I don't gotta read wind. I can just put it center crosshair, man. Take a deep breath, exhale it, send it. You know, I can do all that. And I remember like sitting in there and like, dude, it's really cold this morning. I think this match was in like March.
It was March.
Yeah, it was March, and I was like super cold. And I figured like before we went up there, in my head, I'm like, I gotta warm up. I gotta exercise. Like, I gotta do some push ups. I gotta get warmed up, get the blood flowing. I'm like, nah. I'm not going to be that nerd. Like, peer pressure. I can't be doing push-ups for this. So I just got in the truck. Just like, yep, I'm going to make this shot. I couldn't hit the broadside of a barn from inside of that truck, even if the door was closed and I had a shotgun. Like, I couldn't hit that door because I was so cold.
It was freezing. I'm not gonna lie. It was really cold. And yes, though, he may not have felt there was wind going on inside that bread truck.
No, dude, I was warming the truck.
There was definitely wind going on. And what was it? First shot was like what, 800 to a grand?
Yeah, it was actually like 990 and some change. It was like 996 or something. It was like super close to 1,000.
Yeah, on half silhouette C zone targets too. And
it wasn't a full E type silhouette.
No, it was pretty impressive. Just watching these guys go through this stuff and
By full E type silhouette, I'm talking like a target that's 18 inches wide by 40 inches tall ish, if I recall correctly. And I've got a target that's half that distance at 1,000. Like that's a really hard shot to make.
Yeah, that wasn't even half of it. There was other stages and stuff where you're shooting like a 4-inch plate over, past 600 to 700 yards, and I'm just like, you have 90 seconds per stage. Every stage is 90 seconds.
And there's at least 10 rounds per stage.
10 rounds per stage, offer different firing positions, whether it be tank traps, the back of a bread truck, for example, out of a tree stand.
That's a good point, because that tree stand, it's literally a tree stand, like a hunting deer stand. And I could not hit, for whatever reason, I could not smack a full-sized deer at 400. For whatever reason, I couldn't hit the deer. But yet, I could hit a target at 800, but I couldn't smack the deer at 400, for whatever reason it was. That's a good point, is like, you could be the best sniper in the world. I think that's why I gravitated more towards the precision rifle instead of like the pistol, like USPSA, IDPA, is because there are factors in the precision world that no matter how great of a shooter you are, it will never be the same everywhere you go. Where versus I go to like an IDPA or USPSA match, and it's just like, how creative can you be in the stage? Not necessarily like what are the conditions that you can't predict going to do to you. And it's that uncertainty of there's things that I can't predict that force me to learn in the worst possible scenarios that make that more challenging and more exciting to me, because you could be the top shooter in the world and I could be the worst shooter in the world, and you and I could have, you could have a $5,000 gun and I could have a $500 gun, and that target could be at 400 yards and I could hit it and you could not.
That's very true. Actually, I think they did a War Rifle really good job putting on that event down there. And, it was, going back to your first podcast, man, it was a good way to feed the rat, man. I feel like I was back in the Army, trucking around in the mud, the cold, and hanging out with a good group of guys. And, you know, like I said, going into the intro, I 100% agree with you. You don't need a $2,000 to $5,000 gun. You just need a gun with a decent scope and a sandsaw. These other guys you're going to team up with, they're going to have everything you could possibly think of. And guess what? They're going to let you use it. And that's the awesome part of it was, is a lot of these guys were sharing information. They were always, you know, not trying to screw each other over and be like, oh, I'm not sharing information with you just because I hit that target. Like, no, man, they're helping each other out. Like, hey, man, I got this wind dial, or I got this wind speed, and I see the mirage going from here. He's like, oh, you're too high. You might want to, you know, cut your dials in half. And then there's other instances where we had a police sniper that was down on our team, and you were able to give him a huge wealth of knowledge on, you know, the importance of just optic selection. I think he was shooting a mil dot.
Yeah, he was shooting, if I recall, he was shooting a really old optic.
Yeah, it was a really old, I can't remember what brand it was, but it was definitely a mil dot. And
mil dot, meaning, for those that don't understand, a mil dot is a solid crosshair reticle, right, that has dots. They're like little polka dots all the way up and down the reticle. And those dots are a certain measurement and size. And we'll get back in, you know, we'll in a later podcast, we'll discuss reticles and optic selection, because I can spend a whole 4 hours on optics. I can spend a whole another 4 hours in bipods. So, I mean, we're already at basically an hour for this podcast. We're not going to get into that because that's a whole nother episode. But absolutely, this guy was shooting a mil dot is an older reticle.
Yeah, it was just, you know, you kind of felt himself. He felt that pressure, and that guy had to, you know, he was shooting, going from targets from 400 out to 1,000 or 1,000 plus, and the mil dot just wasn't able to cut it for his holdover, so he had to figure out how to dial. And part of that, too, is, you know, we go back into the importance of truing and zeroing where you're shooting, right? And then
truing, for those that don't know, is establishing the speed of the day. And the speed of the day is where you achieve, you know, like Mach 1.2, which is the sound barrier. So your bullet, when it fires out of a barrel, it at some point it has to achieve the sound barrier. And that's external ballistics. And so there are three types of ballistics. There's internal, external, and terminal ballistics. Internal is what the bullet does while it's in the barrel of the rifle. External is what it does during the flight to the target. And terminal is ballistics is what the bullet does while it's in the target, whether it be paper, an animal, or a human being. Which, I mean, I guess we are animals at the end of the day, but that's what the bullet does, how it tumbles, how it breaks apart, how it flowers, or how it doesn't break apart and just goes straight through. And that kind of gets into like the 5.56 category when you have different, you know, M855s. But that's, we'll go over ballistics and bullet selection for the Army and hunting in a different podcast. Again, we could go for hours upon this stuff. I know you and I could, because we're learning so much between each other. But
absolutely.
You know, just being, having seen that SWAT sniper out there, like, I realized how, like behind SWAT snipers are in the conventional police world.
Yeah, I would definitely say, you know, there's a lot of, you know, like we said, when we were going through that, the law enforcement instructor course, I feel like we, you know, we passed along into a lot of knowledge. And this is just, you know, your basic carbine or AR-15 platform.
Or M4.
M4 yeah. Rifle series. And just kind of like the function and flow of how they set up their equipment or the way they wore their gear or how they're holding the rifle and they're presenting from, you know, a low ready to a high ready stance. So there's a lot of information we were able to share with these guys just based off of our,
I think you and I were the only two military experience. In that entire course.
Yeah, we were the only two military guys. There was a couple, you know, early Iraq invasion. There was one Iraq invasion Marine Corps veteran.
I think everyone else was a local police guy who needed to be like their department's training officer. I think there was a couple of Department of Energy dudes that were like focused on like nuclear based security. And I will admit that those dudes were so ate up. I'm pretty sure one of those guys had a shotgun with his M4.
Yeah. You know, by the end of the day, like I said, most of these courses we go to is kind of go to, you know, it's you kind of just shut your mouth and you be humble and you listen to what the instructor's trying to say. You never know, man. You might learn something new and see something that's a different way of doing something, and you definitely see a lot of what not to do. But you know, there's always something that some new knowledge or a different terminology or a different way of breaking down a technique or a drill that you can always add to your kit book and take with you. And that's what it's about, right? It's about leading people and teaching them how to do something better. So I'm hopefully a lot, you know, some of those guys that we were working with was able to, you know, bring that back to the department or wherever they're from and take the knowledge we passed on to them and hopefully do it a better way. And that's what it's all about, right? You know, making people understand the basics and the fundamentals and how to do things right and not understand the what, but the why we're doing it.
So when you got to the precision rifle world, what was kind of the first thing you picked up on? Like, what was the first thing you started to be like, all right, I definitely need to focus on this the most?
You know, so I was working with you, and we were working on, you were teaching me, you know, it was kind of like a shotgun blast of information at once, man. I was learning how to, you know, call wind and the different beer math variations, or we call swag.
Scientific, dude, beer math is like the standard.
Scientific wild-ass guesses of, you know, rounding up to the wholest number and doing those formulas. But it was a lot more than that, you know. It's kind of understanding the, you know, the type of caliber you're shooting, the grainage, the powder, and this goes way beyond just the fundamentals of shooting itself. But you got to think of it this: when you're trying to shoot precision rifle, like, you're a master of the basic fundamentals. Now there's more elements involved into it. Now you have to pay attention to your wind speed. You got to look at the mirage. You got to look at temperature. You got to look at the elevation change. You got to look at, you know, targetry. You got to figure out how to quickly dial if you're using MOAs versus mils on, you know, I'm shooting a 6.5 mil and I'm at a 700 yard target. And now I'm shooting at 1,000. Well, I got to dial up like 3 and being able to quickly adjust that and adjust with parallax as well as pay attention to different wind speeds. There's a lot more variables.
Not the focus knob, the parallax knob.
Parallax knob, not focus knob, and kind of just, you know, there's a lot more elements tied into that that you have to, and I think that's what's really, really draws me to it, is the fact that, you know, one, is something that I can share with you as a close friend of mine, it's something we can do together, but I'm learning a lot more about the craft, and I truly appreciate the challenge, and that's what it is. It's a challenge every day, and whether I focus on just the outcome, or I try to learn the performance steps
to achieve that outcome. And I think that's where you help me in watching these matches. I see different styles of doing stuff and how guys set up their equipment differently, or they look at the targetry and they're like, okay, you know, and they may not shoot first. They watch somebody else do it. And like, oh, this is what this guy did. I got to make sure I not do that. And then they do the exact opposite and go in the opposite direction. It's like, okay. And then they share that information. Like, what'd you do? Oh, man, I was holding a .4. Okay, what's, like, we're going to point, you know, like, I'm going to hold a .2. And then that guy, you know, he barely misses. And it's like, all right, I'm going to hold a .1.5. And it's just so fine-tuned. You're like, dude, like, what is it, man? What are you shooting? Well, I'm shooting .308. Well, I'm shooting 6.5 Creedmoor. Or I'm shooting 6 Dasher,
like,
you know?
Yeah, 6 Dasher. Or just 6 mil in general. Like, all right, dude, can we pick a caliber here?
Yeah. And that's what I think is also unique about the series, too, is you also get to kind of get a taste of, like, these, you know, you see these guys' awesome setups, and you're like, man, pretty much your rifle's worth more than everything in my, you know, my gun safe right now, but hey, man, I'm out here with a 308 or a 6.5 Creedmoor that I paid $800 for and threw a $300 optic on. YOLO, man, let's send it, you know?
And I'm still keeping up with you. That's one thing is, like when I watched IDPA or USPSA or whatever, like, so for those that don't know, you and I went to the All-Army Marksmanship Championship in 2016, which is, it was a huge learning experience for us. And I remember, like, I had never had any formal instruction with pistol, and I literally just, we went to the range and just shot. And it was at the point where it was like -5 degrees outside, and we were reloading ammo in the vehicle so we could get warm.
Tortured ourselves.
Dude, it was horrible.
For a reason, though. You know, we went to the New Hampshire state match.
It was right? So we should probably back up and explain EIC exactly. And why it's relevant to just units in general. So in the Army, everyone's heard of the President's 100s tab, but below the President's 100s tab is the Chief's 50, I think is what it's That's called. Correct. And below the Chief's 50 is the Governor's 20. And those are like state-level matches that are organized at the National Guard or Reserve level. However, the big picture to this is that when the Civilian Marksmanship Program started in 1901, it was funded by Congress. And Congress said, hey, everyone in the country needs to know how to shoot a rifle, because there's a huge gap in technology when you're going from muskets to lever actions. Now we have bolt actions, shooting 30-06 versus 30-30, that's a huge ballistic gap. That's a fairly big ballistic gap, right? And now everyone needs to know how to shoot. So Congress decided that, hey, we're going to make some awards for this that can be awarded by Congress. And you have bronze, silver, and gold, which is also known as distinguished. And in the military, that can be put on your ERB. Now, all the Army Marksmanship Unit guys, they live, breathe, eat, sleep, bullseye shooting on Camp Perry, and they want their EIC badges. And the EIC badge is a permanent award, where versus your regular marksmanship badge is not a permanent award. And that's why you have to requalify every year. You maintain proficiency, and you're given an award to show your proficiency. However, if you shoot an expert and next year you shoot marksman, like, your badge changes. But if you shoot EIC and you place in the top 10% of that particular match and you're awarded your EIC badge, you can never go down a badge. But you can only go up by consistently placing in the top 10% over multiple matches. So you have to be consistently accurate throughout multiple matches. And there's two different EIC badges. There's rifle and pistol. And for you to have both is pretty rare. Like, I know our buddy Howell, he'll be on probably in October. He's a sniper as well as an AMU guy. He has some Olympic medals for shooting and that sort of stuff. He's really the guy that kind of set forth for me EIC. And the unit that you and I were in before, we didn't have guns or ammo, so we had to find a way. You know, we'll get into that other podcast because it's actually an interesting podcast. We'll talk about that later on. But those badges definitely help instill the iron sight perspective of shooting.
It was humbling for sure.
You could say it was modern competition at its earliest age.
Yeah, it was definitely. I would agree with that. And you know, kind of looking at it too, it's like, what do you get trained in and go through basic training? Like, okay, we're shooting iron sights. Some units now are shooting optics for qualifications, and it's at basic training level. And the importance of it is I've never in my military career had an opportunity like that or a challenge to shoot to almost a maximum proficiency or a maximum
what we're trying to get is that it's bullseye based. it's not I don't want to say broadside based, but when you shoot EIC, it's how close can you get to the mark. It's marksmanship at its purest form. Marksmanship is hitting the mark. The mark being the X, the center bullseye. That's marksmanship at its basic, historic, core fundamentals, hitting the mark.
Well, and then you also look at it, too, when you look at the, you know, Army doctrine for marksmanship or for shooting with a rifle. It's, you know, you're beyond the target identification line. You're shooting beyond what's supposed to be match capability. So you're basically you're shooting at a level of the max performance of a rifle in a term. 600 yards with the iron sights, whether you're dealing with wind and cold and difference in terrain, and it doesn't really matter, but what it teaches you is far more superior than what you could ever think of, and that's just with the iron sights. That's learning how to, you know, use your rear sight aperture and change the elevation and, you know, change the windage, or to some of us that have the hardcore Kentucky windage measures, you're slicing your front sight post into thirds.
The only reason you have that is because you read that in the manual.
Yeah, just because it's faster than dialing, you know, your windage on the rear sight aperture.
And which, by the way, the front sight post is usually anywhere from 6 to 6.5 minutes of angle and width for each bullseye at your respective range. So if you're at 100 yards, it's 6.5. If you're at 1,000 yards, it's roughly 6.5 minutes of angle. So your front sight post is actually a measuring tool. And what he's talking about, or what Anthony's talking about, is cutting that into thirds so you can gauge your wind speed and use your front sight post as a measuring tool to measure the ballistic change in the bullet being drifted in by the wind.
Yeah, and that was, you know, when we going back to the All-Army match that we went to, that was a whole different animal. One, it was kind of a disadvantage for us. We had gone issued some basic training guns, and we didn't actually get a chance to really zero those weapons. We did,
No, I think we just tossed that in the line and said, hey, get some siders.
We did a range verification, which was a one-round shot at...
It was at 100, right?
At 100, back all the way back to 600. And what they do is you shoot one round, they pull the target down, they put a postmark up in it. So you're trying to, like, shoot a weapon that you're not particularly zero to you, was in the hands of some unknown hooligan before you, and you're trying to, like, okay, where is my base zero at? So
you don't have a chance to really put in your zero to, like, as close as to the bullseye you could get before you shoot this match.
So, one, it was kind of a lot of, go back to that term, swag, some scientific wild-ass guessing going on for us. Like, all right, here's my holds.
I'm just going to hold it, dude, and see what happens.
And then guess what? You go into the first match the next day, and there's literally vortex winds. Winds moving from the...
Like, at 400, there's a 10-mile-an-hour wind going from right to left. You get to 300, and it's a 15-mile-an-hour wind from left to right.
So it was a guessing game the entire time, and every day was different. I mean, there was one match, I remember we started out, I was squatted early in the morning to shoot, and it was cold. In March at Fort Benning, very odd, frost on the ground. You know, and I figured out, you know, either I could run to get to the next match. Usually they always set us back 100 yards.
What you're talking about is the match where you're assaulting forward.
Yeah, so you're basically assaulting forward, you're assaulting 100 yards forward, right?
And then you get to that 100-yard mark, and then you engage your target. Yeah, so the idea is to get your heart rate up a little bit.
Record slow far, right?
Right.
So I'm like, okay, why get my heart rate up and get all crazy? I'll just walk it and then take, you know, some accurate shots instead of wasting my time trying to catch, you know, slow my heart rate down, catch my breath, and focus on what I'm getting ready to do. Well, I get down there, and I take my first exhale, and fog. Boom. Front of everything. Can't see nothing because it's so cold that the fog from my breath, so I'm sitting here blowing outside the side of my mouth trying to shoot these targets. I'm like, all right. Then the wind's picked up, not even about, I would say, we probably got to stage two of the match. The wind's picked up again. So now I'm trying to hold my, you know, like, exhale out of the side of my mouth and trying to dice this wind in half using my front sight post. I'm cutting it into thirds. Like, okay, I'm going to hold it, you know, the right side of the edge of the target of the bullseye. And then next round, the wind changed. I'm like, all right, now I'm going to hold the opposite side. So,
I mean, that brings up a good point, is that dialing isn't always the best way to gauge your wind. You can't just be like, yep, wind's a... I mean, I will admit, in Kansas, when I was stationed at Fort Riley, there'll be a 50-mile-an-hour wind across the range. But it's consistent from right to left. There's no vortexes. I'll admit that I didn't, not until I got to New England. The winds aren't very strong. The worst case scenario, you'll find a 20 mile an hour wind in New England. However, you'll find wind vortices at every 100 yard differences all the way down the range. You will not find a consistent one way across the wind, or one wind across the range all day at extremely high speeds. Essentially, it's like holding a zero because you can predict that wind's going to stay at 40 miles an hour all day. You just dial the 40 miles an hour, and that's your new zero for wind. Versus New England, it's 500 yards is a 5 mile an hour change from right to left. 300 yards is a 10 mile an hour change from left to right. 200 yards is a right to left, another 5 mile an hour change. And it's just a big, picture like a Z across the range. That's how wind is all the way across the range in New England. It's never one consistent speed. And I think most of it is that all the trees are usually set up, because there's so much vegetation in New England, that all the trees just create different avenues of approach for the wind to come down and whip and then turn up and spin out. So it's never like, and I'm sure you get this like in Washington, where, you know, you have big mountains and sloping valleys, especially up in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. It's pretty, I mean, you have Mount Washington has the coldest weather consistently on the face of the planet. And also the White Mountains have some of the fastest wind speeds ever recorded in human history, over 200 miles an hour for wind. And we're in that same wind category, like that same area. I know if I change from Salisbury, New Hampshire to Concord, that's only a 15-minute drive by vehicle. And there'll be a completely different wind vortex, or not a wind vortex, but there'll be completely different wind gradients between the two areas. Snowfall will be completely different by feet in the winter. You get further down towards the coast, completely different terrain and completely different weather conditions. You have all of the world's weather conditions in one compact area, but what you don't have is super fast winds at like 50 miles an hour.
And I definitely agree with that too, because I remember there's a lot of times being out in Arizona, you know, it'd be, you know, basically shooting a wild game, deer hunting, elk hunting across, you know, large draws and stuff, and the winds just rip through there, but it's consistent. It's a consistent wind speed, and I had some of the tools that I know now on how to be able to look at the vegetation and kind of get a good guesstimation on, you know, reading mirage and figuring out what that wind speed is, probably would have a lot more trophies hanging in my dad's garage. But going into those learning points, you know, kind of going into that, the hunting aspect of it. Same thing with these guys, you know, they, you know, I was telling my dad, I'm like, well, you know, when's the last time you zeroed that rifle? It was last July. I was like, wow, it was like 100 degrees. And you were at, what, 3,000 feet there? You know, it was basically where my hometown's
at. The dead city altitude for the day.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, you know, it was at this range and whatnot. And, you know, he's like, well, I'm going hunting in November. Well, a lot of people don't realize that, yes, Arizona does get cold, especially high up in the mountains. It's not all desert. So, you know, there's some drastic changes in temperature for one, but you also have an elevation increase, which also affects your ballistic data.
Yeah, because it changes. It's a completely different wind gradient. And that gets back to the wind, the air density. The bullet may, so in the aviation world, and this is the best way to explain it, in the aviation world, you have AGL and MSL, and AGL is above ground level. So no matter what, if I take a measuring tape, let's say we're at we know at the top of this mountain, it is 3,000 feet, okay? And that's from sea level. But above ground level, if I was to take a measuring tape and drop it straight down to the ground, let's say I have a 90-degree cliff right in front of me, and I take a measuring tape and I drop it down, and it says 3,000 feet, right? That's my AGL. That's how far above I am to the lowest point in the ground below me. And then there's mean sea level, which is how the air density is affecting the flight of the bullet. So even though I'm at 3,000 feet above ground level, the bullet could still feel the effects of flying through the air at 4,500 feet, 4,500 feet above, because of the thickness of the air. And so when a bullet flies through the air, the only portion of the bullet that's actually touching the wind or the air is just the tip. Just the tip is touching the wind, and that's it. And it creates literally a triangular effect at like a 45-degree angle off the tip of the bullet. And that's what really affects your ballistic trajectory And like you're saying, like those winds are consistent, and people don't understand that high elevation versus your ground elevation. Because yeah, they go to the range and they zero at 100 feet, and they go up to 3,000 feet. The air is different. The temperature is different. Their holds are different. Like, and this gets back to the long picture that sniping started with hunters that understood this and figured it out by the hard way. Like, hey, I'm not hitting the target at this distance. Why is that? They just ask the simple question, why? And then they begin to change their technology, and they begin to change their approach to training. And that's why the sniping, the hunter, and the precision rifle shooter, the competitive, I don't want to say game-like competitor, not game as an animal, but game as in like precision rifle series, like the competition aspect, it's super important for everyone to understand, because the ghillie suit, the marksman in back in the 1700s, they all started with the hunter. The hunter is the one that said, hey, here's how you hunt an animal. If you can hunt an animal, you can hunt a human. And by hunting humans, you can save more lives. So that whole aspect, this whole culture is interconnected. But what now the modern sniper is realizing is all this technology and scientific advancement has brought us to the age of technology where we can understand what's happening with ballistics and optics and barometric pressures and atmospheric conditions. And now we can relay that down to the hunter. And the hunter can be more successful in their hunt by understanding the training aspect, understanding the optic, understanding their bullets and ballistics have completely different, you know, different trajectory paths than just, I need to go zero at 100 degrees and then go shoot November when it's 25 out.
And I'd say actually a perfect lesson, going back to the story of my father, and he was telling me, he was like, yeah, man, he was out hunting mule deer, and he was making it was close to about a 600-yard shot. And he said, he was like, oh, I missed. I was probably about 7 inches high. And he's like, I don't understand. I was using this ballistic app thing. But what he doesn't understand is that he's never actually applied these what this ballistic data is telling him. He doesn't really understand it. So I was trying to explain, you know, it's just the base information. Like, hey, you zeroed your rifle at dang near 100 degrees, and now you're at a 40-degree temperature, and not only that, you're 4,000 feet higher in elevation. So I'm trying to explain and kind of break down this ballistic data, saying this is why you missed, basically. Like, yeah, you were zeroed, you know, 600 yards, no problem, at 3,000 feet, 100 degrees, but when's the last time you touched that gun? Did you shoot that gun when you came up there to your hunting area within the relative temperature and elevation zone that you were in? No. The only thing you did was this app told you to adjust, you know, 5 mils higher, and you still missed by 6 inches. So the importance of training and understanding, you know, the variations of these, not only atmospheric data that can affect your terminal ballistics, but how do you apply ballistic information from these apps and stuff?
Yeah. So actually, to come back around to the sniper, it's super important to understand your ballistic data. Because when you enter the precision rifle world, it is all about data, 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 data. There's no reconnaissance in the precision rifle world unless you're at a practical match where you have to scan for your target. And those matches, like the Sniper's Hide Cup, that is a match out in Washington this past year that just happened, that it's a practical engagement. You scan the tree line, you look for the game to engage, and they're usually steel cutouts, and you engage that target. You have to understand your ballistic data. But I guess the big picture is that the sniper world relies on the hunting world, and the hunting world relies on the sniper world to give it feedback and give it that technical edge of what happens when shit's in a hurry. When you're engaging moving targets in a hurry under stress, they need to know that because they're hunting against wild game. That, hey, you come across an animal like an elk, and that dude's like, hey, man, I'm out here and it's my territory and I'm going to do elk stuff. And the hunter gets super excited because he either paid or put a lot of time into this, and that dude doesn't understand his ballistic data. But at the same time, technology is advancing so much in that side that the hunter wants to buy the newest, latest, greatest technology to continue to get successful hunts. Well, the sniper world is also behind in that because the army can only afford what it can afford, versus the civilian and the hunter can afford whatever he can buy whatever the hell he wants. Whereas the army can't do that's what's issued, right? But that's where the hunter pushes the precision rifle world and the sniper world into new heights. So it's all interconnected, right? As an example, the 6.5 Creedmoor and 264 USA and 6mm. The Swiss have been using 6mm since World War I. And all of a sudden, we're now back into 6mm in the precision rifle world. Like, it's this new, big, and great cartridge. Dude, America's catching up to the Swiss from World War I. Like, they're straight bolt action rifles. Like, the Swiss were onto something. Like, I was watching a guy the other day that had a precision rifle, like a modern precision rifle, the straight bolt. That dude didn't even have to flick his wrist. He just literally moved his two fingers and the gun, the bolt went forwards, backwards. That's it. He didn't have to come off the optic, nothing. He didn't have to move his hand. It was like a leap in technology just based on how the bolt was set up. And now he's still shooting 6mm. And the difference in energy transferred into the soldier between shoulder, between 308, 30-06, and 6mm is drastically different. And all of a sudden now the precision world is catching up to 6mm. Well, then the hunting world caught up to 6mm. So you have Hornady and you have like stuff with Sierra Match King. It's all in 6mm or 6.5 Creedmoor, which is essentially 6mm. It's 6.5mm, right? It's one step below 7mm. And the Germans back in World War I and World War II were using 8mm, which is closer to 30-06. So in the long run, we're just coming around full circle, the same caliber that's been used over and over and over again. It may be more refined because we go from G1 to G7 ballistic coefficients, which is just understanding the ogive of the round and understanding how the round flies through and using Doppler radar to predict the construction of the round, how it flies through. And this is really loosely putting it because I don't understand all of it yet. I'm not a big ballistic guy. I prefer to just go to the store, buy my match-grade ammunition, which is good enough now, and I can shoot match-grade ammunition from the factory, from Hornady, 6.5 Creedmoor, 140 grains, and still compete with a guy who hand reloads his rounds. The only reason that you hand reload now is to squeeze every ounce, every possible inch out of accuracy of your gun. But in the long run, to be honest with you, I would encourage guys not to go into like an open class in precision rifle. I would encourage them more to go into production class. Because like I'm ranked 8th in production class in the country right now. And if you go into production class, the equipment that you have really shows how good your fundamentals are. But if you go into open class, you buy away your deficiencies. If you have a crappy trigger pull, or if you have crappy breathing, or you have improper sight alignment, sight picture, or you don't understand your data, you buying equipment makes you a better shooter to a certain point. When that production shooter shows up and he's shooting a 4-pound trigger, and you're shooting a 1/2-ounce trigger, and that 4-pound trigger guy on his Remington 700 straight from the factory is smoking you because he understands the fundamentals far more effectively than you do because you're buying your way through it. And that's why I like hunting, precision rifle, and sniping all are intertwined in one big web. And that creativity aspect in relation to combat is there. The procurement of match-grade ammunition, the procurement of match-grade optics, the procurement of match-grade guns is all intertwined into the creativity of how a sniper employs himself in the combat zone. And that's vitally important. So if you're a sniper right now, you have to understand that that hunter that keeps his gun in his gun case and only takes it out once a year and thinks he's good to go, you need to go talk to him. Just like you're talking to your dad. You got to show your dad the difference between A, B, C, and X, Y, Z. And now I'm sure your dad understands it, and he's beginning to tweak his ballistics and his guns a little bit so he understands it more, so he increases his probability of scoring a successful hunt.
Definitely, it's brought a lot of insight coming in. And I actually think, you know, that video shoot that we did at a gun site kind of definitely he got a little eye-opening, like, yeah, my son is now the teacher and I'm the student aspect to it. But, you know, as you said, we're going into, you know, we're starting to talk about this hunting aspect is, you know, it's a lot of it is kind of like, there is kind of like being a sniper in a sense, right? There's some aspects of reconnaissance that are involved into being a hunter and kind of knowing your zone or your area that you're trying to, you know, figure out where the major movements is of the game that you're trying to hunt, developing patterns, you know, what times of day they're moving, whether they're coming in to feed, whether they're going to bed, whether they're coming in for water, and you're trying to figure out, okay, what's the major pathways they're coming from, and, you know, it's not always cut and dry, you know, there's differences in hunting in different areas for sure. I mean, I've been hunting in North Carolina, where it was a completely different world to me growing up out west in Arizona, and I went with a buddy of mine, he put me up in some box deer stand thing, and he was like, just take a nap, and I would never have done that ever growing up in Arizona.
You're more of like the tracker. You have to have the reconnaissance.
Yeah, aspect. Definitely. Arizona is the game is a lot more dispersed, and you have to track and you have to work hard. You have to develop those patterns of life, and you have to figure out, like I said, exactly where they're coming in, the times. You have to start developing patterns, evaluate the terrain, whether it's, you know, temperature based, whether they're going to be higher, lower in elevation. Out east, I woke up in this box stand, and there was this shooting lane with these deer feeders set up, and there was more whitetail deer than I've ever seen in my entire life in one place. And it was like shooting fish in a barrel. It was kind of cool.
I would even say, and I know some hunters are going to get really pissed off and delete this podcast, but I would say that's unethical. And I would say that loosely, because the idea of the hunter is that they're a woodsman. They track, they understand game signs, they understand the patterns of animals, and they're not static. If you're baiting an animal with a feed plot, are you really a hunter? Or are you an ambusher at that point?
Basically, I would, you know, that's actually a good point to put that. To me, it kind of felt like ambushing. It was still an awesome experience. But the differences in the area is, back east is, I'm not sure if there's as many hunters or just there's so much game to do population control that it's an allowed thing, because out west in Arizona, there's definitely no baiting allowed, even though you have to walk hundreds of miles and search, you know, different areas and different, you know, tons terrain. Of different hunting terrain, and it's just there's no baiting. That's just what it is. But the game isn't as heavily populated
as, like, isn't it as plentiful
out west. Yes, or out west.
Okay, Lieutenant. Yeah. Should I stand a parade rest for you and attention right after that?
My 4th Infantry Division coming in right there.
Yeah, okay, sir.
Lots pointing north.
Half right face.
But I think that would probably be, because I've known some guys that were out of, you know, their families own some apple farms up in New York, and they don't even have to have a hunting license or game tags. If it's on their property, yeah, they shoot property. It. And they shoot a lot of them because the game is heavily populated, and they're actually more of a pest than anything.
You know, when I took a class, when I started going back to college, I figured out of the Army, I took a class in psychology and anthropology. And in anthropology, they got in specifically, well, a little bit of both. I had the same teacher for anthropology and sociology. And she was talking about the communication between animals and the social norms, and anthropology about the animal patterns and stuff like that. It was really weird how she was, like, interchanging both classes. But she was talking to New Hampshire Fish and Game Wildlife Service guy, and he was talking about coyotes, and coyotes have a specific call, and if you kill a coyote and they do a call and that coyote doesn't return, their litter population, when they procreate, you know, they begin to mate again, the normal coyote that's not under distress will populate one pup per pregnancy. But if you kill a coyote in that pack, that pup, that female, now when they're in pregnancy, can generate up to 6 pups because you've taken away one animal from the pack. So you're actually contributing to the growth of the population by killing more coyotes. Which I heard this and I was like, I need a full auto. I am not a sniper anymore. I need Rambo's about to come out for coyotes. And the other day, literally what's today? Thursday night? Wednesday, yesterday, we had a fox come on my mom's farm and kill one of our chickens in broad daylight right in front of my dog. And my dog had turned around and saw the fox devouring the chicken. And my mom couldn't get to the gun in time. The dog couldn't react to the chicken in time. And the fox couldn't react to the chicken getting mauled while the dog was freaking out. And this is Charlie, my chocolate lab, who's a hunting dog and loves hunting. And she was just like, oh my God, finally I get to kill something. And the fox was like, oh my God, finally something's going to kill me. And it was like, my mom said there's like this weird stare down. Like, the fox has the chicken in its mouth, and the dog staring at the fox, which has the chicken in its mouth, and the fox is just clamping down on the chicken. My mom is calling me while I'm at work, working with the battalion commander, like, hey, the dog is about to kill a fox, which is killing the chicken. You need to come home. Like, I need help. And at the same time, I'm like, you realize that coyotes pass through our farm all the time. And now all of a sudden you're worried about a fox. We should be worried about the coyote population and how we can address this issue. Because you know a coyote is going to be far more aggressive when it's hungry and devour that chicken population that we have on the farm. And it could even get so aggressive as to challenge my dog.
That's definitely very true. And I would say, you know, coming from the west to east, especially around the metropolis of New England here, I have never seen so many turkeys in my life.
The only place I've ever seen more turkeys is Fort Drum. In upstate New York. The turkey population there is insane.
It doesn't matter. I'm going down, you know, I can go down the road no matter what time of day, and there's a whole brood of turkeys going on, and Jake's with beards dragging on the ground, and one Tom flexing his stuff, and I'm like,
That's like a couple of years ago when we were going to work at the Natick Labs. Yeah. Which we'll get into the topic of Natick Labs when it comes to physical fitness, and we'll do another podcast for this, because we were exposed to some really crazy studies in the Army, especially from marksmanship side. But him and I are driving to work, and he's behind me in his truck, and I've got my Jeep, and there's a turkey in the middle of like a main highway, basically. So in New England, you have highways and you have routes, and routes are like a mini highway, basically. It's a main avenue of approach. Well, I would say it's an alternate supply route versus a main supply route. It's an ASP or ASR versus an MSR.
Well, it's all a madhouse here in New England, but
To do with all the original cow pastures when we formed as a country. That's where most of our stuff is all of our highways and our main routes and our routes, you know, sub routes. That's all original cow paths. They're not like New York City where it's cut and dry grid squares.
It's a spaghetti ball.
It's literally a big, gigantic spaghetti ball. But continue.
Turkish. Well, you know, it was. So we were coming off of Route 9 onto Route 27 south.
And which is just, it's like a one lane, like, sub highway.
And here we are. We're getting ready to pull on 27. I'm right behind Justin in his Jeep, and there's this gigantic Tom standing on the corner, fan flared out, trying to fight Justin's Jeep tire. And I was like, wow, this is probably one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. And two, like, what is going on here? Like, hunters?
We're in a downtown city area. Yeah. And this turkey's like, bro, I'm going to annihilate your tire. And I have big, like, 35-inch mud terrain tires. And that turkey was like, dude. And what's even worse is I couldn't see the turkey. Yeah. I could only hear you calling me on the phone. Like, dude, you have a turkey, like, attacking your Jeep.
It was crazy. It was like I was able to take a couple pictures of it and call him, and this thing was so just like, oh, you're in my AO, man. Like, I'm gonna take you on. I'm done. This is my highway now. And it's just the way it is. I drive around New England, and like I said, there's turkeys everywhere. I'm like, dude, does nobody hunt up here? And then, you know, we start getting into, you know, the gun laws around this area and bow hunting, and it's just,
That's another, like, podcast way down the line. Because all laws against guns are an infringement, and that's against the Constitution, in my personal opinion. However, that turkey, him and I still have it out to this day, and eventually, I'm going to find that Tom. I'm going to scuff that ass. Like, that turkey, him and I, we get a lifelong vendetta against each other.
He's too busy living on somebody's roof in Natick.
That's true. At the Natick Research Development Center, the only active duty base from the Army in the entire New England area, there's a turkey living in there. Like, I remember we had the coyote in a downtown city area that got onto the base, and the gate guards couldn't find the coyote and was living on our base for, like, ever.
Yeah. Talk about training aspect right there. Some boys that need some training for sure. Could overrun that place with a squirt gun. Anyways.
Well, yeah, anyway. So speaking of that, there's one thing that I kind of want to leave off with. We've had a great podcast. We're like an hour and a half and some change now. So all of the things in this podcast, they are OPSEC kind of focused at certain times, or they will become OPSEC focused, which is operational security. Eventually, everything that I pull from the internet to discuss certain things will, like I said, be from the internet. So if I can find it on Google, anyone in the world can find it on Google. So we won't discuss anything on the podcast that is sensitive in nature or puts any of our boys at risk. So as I used to say, loose lips sink ships. And I'm not about hurting any sniper or cavalry scout or even a cook in any way, shape, or form. You know, we have enemies in this world. Already on the analytics of this podcast, I've noticed that there are people in South Korea and there's people in Mexico listening to the podcast. So if you're there, just understand that the American sniper is the best marksman in the world. And I won't give information away to possibly hinder their performance in the battlefield. So that being said, operational security is the utmost importance for us. If we can find it on the internet, you can find it on the internet. But also that means that our tactics have evolved and that you can't find out what we're exactly doing. So that's just a little note for tonight. But so anyway, if you've tuned in for this hour and a half, we appreciate it. And Sandoval, it was a pleasure having you on tonight. And well, maybe we'll do some more stuff tonight where we kind of rag, or not tonight, but later on we rag on the Cav for not being true snipers when they send their guys to sniper school. But anyway, so if you listen to the podcast tonight again, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Make sure you like, subscribe, you follow along. Next weekend, today's the 25th. Next weekend of August 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, I will be in Colorado for the U.S. Army Sniper Association and Marine Corps Scout Sniper Association gathering. And we will have Joe Milley on the podcast, who is the first ever sniper to graduate U.S. Army Sniper School, having a prosthetic leg. He's wounded in combat. We'll have him on, along with, like I said, Jedediah Robbins, who's my former sniper section sergeant. We'll have both those guys on the podcast, so make sure you tune in. We have plenty of good content coming up, and we appreciate it. And in closing, from the tall grass, one shot, one kill.